Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Orna Bloom. Orna is a recently retired Foreign Service officer, having served with the State Department for 26 years. She's a strategic communications leader who focuses on driving impact at the intersection of policy, education, and culture. Her expertise is in public diplomacy, and she's worked in media relations, democracy building, crisis management, and launched creative programs that resonate with global audiences. Orna, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Okay, thanks so much for the invitation.
I'm excited to talk with you. So, tell me a little bit about how you found yourself in public service. Where did you grow up and how were you raised?
I am actually one of the few native Washingtonians. Everybody always says that they're new to Washington. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find a local, but I actually grew up in the Washington area, in Maryland suburbs, and I'm living now in Northern Virginia. But I grew up in Maryland with my mom and my brother. And we always had a strong interest in other countries. My background is that I'm half Israeli. My grandparents were immigrants, refugees from Europe. And, just always found an interest and a need to be a part of a larger global community and to recognize that there's something that I need to give back after everything that my grandparents and great-grandparents went through to come to America.
That's so interesting. And I think obviously in America, so many families have a recent or distant immigrant history. And I think the closer you are maybe to that history and to those stories, then the more you have that perspective kind of shaping your thinking about your place in the world and how you want to interact with the world. But I also imagine that growing up in Washington might have been a part of that too. You know, like being surrounded by these conversations about the rest of the world and about domestic and foreign policy. Like, I wasn't hearing so much of this growing up in upstate New York. So I think maybe it was an advantage in Washington too.
Yeah, definitely being in Washington, and also my family, my grandparents, grandparents were in Baltimore. I grew up very close with my family. And so first of all, I would hear so many of the stories of arriving in the United States, the immigrant story.
When did they arrive?
On my mother's side, my great-grandmother and her daughter, my grandmother, mm-hmm. Arrived probably about 1920 mm-hmm. to 23. I'm trying to remember the exact date.
Yeah.
And they were from Minsk. Mm. So now we know it as Belarus. They considered it Russia. That's what they always mm-hmm. call it, the Russian Empire. And my grandfather's family was from Radom in Poland. And they came to the United States, through Ellis Island about mm-hmm. the same time. And their story was classic. You know, the idea of, for example, there was one relative on my grandfather's side who came at age 19 and was working in a factory and managed to bring over a number of relatives. Mm-hmm. Those who did not come did not survive World War II and the Holocaust.
Yeah.
So, a real deep resonance and a real appreciation for everything that that they gave to me and that I'm able to do.
My grandfather also came through Ellis Island and had a story of being like a small child. So it was in the late 1920s when he came with his mom mm-hmm. and siblings too. And I think, and this is fuzzy because so much of this is passed on like by oral history, right? So it's difficult once these people have passed and you can't ask the questions that you have as an adult. But I remember being told that he and his family tried to come one time earlier from Peru, but his father was sick and they weren't able to make it through, I think because he was sick and they weren't quite sure. And so they returned back. He passed away. And then my great grandmother and her three children ended up coming through Ellis Island and living in New York for the rest of their lives. But that's our family history. And he talked about the fact that when they arrived in New York, they had to immediately Americanize their names. So everyone got like a more English version of the name that they were born with, but also being part of the generation that fought in World War II. he had like a sense of pride about becoming a part of this American project and didn't seem to like have bad vibes about having to change his name the way that you might think. But it's just so interesting. So many stories came through that single point and now have like become a part of this larger fabric.
Where did he serve during the war?
He was in Europe. So he was in France most of the time.
So my grandfather, I actually have a copy of my grandfather, one of his diaries during World War II.
What a treasure.
And he had served in London first in the Signal Corps. Mm-hmm. So doing the Morse code and the communications. And then in the journal, you can see that he, when they cross over the channel, and then they were based out of Versailles.
Wow.
After D-Day. So, and the journal was fascinating. Just, you know, little notes, what he wanted to do on his time off.
Yeah.
He wanted to be an English professor and go off to Stratford-upon-Avon.
That is so cool. We don't have anything in writing like that, but my grandfather told a few stories. But the thing is, like, he was the kind of storyteller where everything had a note of humor, because I think that's just how my family deals with dark things. Like, we find humor. And so he told us one story about how he remembers being in a situation where, like, they were under attack and there were bullets going up and bombs coming down, and he dove into, like, the nearest what he thought was like a bunker. It turned out it was actually like the place that they dug out for everyone to use like as the bathroom. And so he landed in there, and he said all he could think was, if I die here, they're gonna find me.
You have to find that self-deprecation.
Yeah. But the stories are amazing. And I talked with Bill Russo on an earlier episode of this podcast about the power of this storytelling and how, you know, it's a bit of a lost art. But I think that the fact that podcasts have become a big thing is actually a great way to take something that's ancient and make it, use technology for good to reconnect.
Absolutely. To reconnect and also to reflect and go, oh my goodness, I had a similar story in my background as you did, Kate. So,
exactly. Yeah, cool. Well, so then how did you end up finding yourself being interested in working in foreign affairs, and particularly in public diplomacy?
Well, you asked about being a Washingtonian.
Yeah.
And certainly I was really lucky that we had, in my high school, there was the offer to join a Youth for Understanding exchange program.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a summer in Sweden in my summer between junior and senior year in high school, and had the chance to live with the family and just kind of get that feeling of living overseas and understanding another culture and getting outside of my own bubble. And I came back from that, and then, you know, in getting ready for college, all I knew is I wanted to somehow bring Americans together with people from other countries and understand each other a little bit better. I didn't know that there was a real definition in a profession for that, but that's what I came away with from that experience.
It's great when you find that the thing that you want to do exists and there's a name for it. And if it doesn't, you can always just make it. But
exactly.
In your case,
for those who don't know, it's public diplomacy.
Yes, in your case, you were lucky that public diplomacy exists. And so then what were some of the highlights of that career journey for you?
Oh, well, it's interesting because after college, like so many people, and you know, Gen Xer, we were working three jobs at a time and hoping, you know, between waitressing and working an office job and then an internship for free, that you'll find some experience that'll be helpful. But I really began my career shortly thereafter. I was 23 years old and I joined the League of Women Voters. And I had studied in college actually international communism and comparative politics to try to understand. This was the time where, actually, I graduated and the Berlin Wall came down.
Wow.
And so I was studying the impact of reform on societies that had a robust history of civil society. And so working for the League of Women Voters and working for an organization that was nationally renowned, 200,000 volunteers dedicated to civic participation in government, in your country, and working with all of these women leaders was extremely powerful. And I had the chance to come on board then start a project that mm-hmm. was actually funded by the U.S. government. It was then known as the U.S. Information Agency, but then mm-hmm. the State Department. And the idea was to put together an exchange program between women leaders, emerging women leaders in Poland, and women in the United States to understand how do you develop a grassroots democracy? And what is your role as an individual? And that was really influential and powerful for me, absolutely formative.
That's amazing. And so then what is it, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about public diplomacy and what the role of public diplomacy is in promoting the national interest in our own national security.
Absolutely. You know, when people think of diplomacy, national security, mm-hmm. I think that many of us, and certainly I did growing up, think it's the Pentagon, it's the military, it's issues that, for want of a better term, have been called sort of like the harder issues. And I don't like calling something hard power or soft power, but that's been defined in the foreign policy field. What public diplomacy is the fact that relations between governments are not the only thing that matters. Matter of fact, it isn't what makes everything tick. It's a relationship between peoples, between citizens of different countries. And that can take place at the university-to-university level, between journalists in different countries, between students. So the experience that I had as a high school exchange student is a part of that public diplomacy. Mm-hmm. The idea that you can bring together business leaders, civic activists, people who are in their own countries working with a lot of the same challenges, and how do you learn from each other? And of course, the late Senator Fulbright, who I think many people have heard about, who has helped to establish the Fulbright Exchange Program. And so, and the whole basis of public diplomacy recognized after World War II, you know what? We don't have to always agree, but if you get to understand each other, if you have a mutual understanding, then you're less likely to go to war with each other. Mm-hmm. And that has always resonated with me, that if you're willing to talk, and I may not agree with you, but you know what? I kind of get where you're coming from. And therefore, that can take me to the next step, and we can talk a little bit more and see where we can come together and try to solve this problem.
Yeah. Well, you just sparked a thought for me, because first of all, do you think it would be fair to say that at this moment that there seems to be waning support or appreciation for the value of public diplomacy?
Absolutely. Unfortunately.
And yeah.
It's not just something that I'm observing. We saw it, unfortunately, in this past week with the congressional notification that went forward in the State Department's reorganization plan and the budget plan. They just want to cut. The current administration does not see many of our traditional public diplomacy programs as being central to the national security interests strategy mm-hmm. that they wish to take right now. And I don't know that bodes so well in the long term for the American people.
Yeah, I've observed the same. And so then it just, when you were speaking, it got me thinking about, you know, the importance of the people in the opinions that they hold, in their understanding of the value of the programs that are kind of being developed and carried out on their behalf. I wonder if maybe a global lack of appreciation or waning appreciation for the value of public diplomacy and soft power, as many people like to refer to it, is connected in some way to the fact that technology has made us more wired to look for instant gratification or to think in the short term. And when you were talking about the value of public diplomacy, I mean, obviously it's not a direct cause and effect, but when you were talking about the value of public diplomacy, I was thinking about the fact that that's something that requires a sustained effort, and you see the gains accrue over time, and it's more of a long-term investment in relationship building. You don't just, you know, start a program and immediately tomorrow see like great economic opportunity for U.S. businesses emerge. It takes time. And I feel like, certainly as a society in the United States, I feel like we have lost a bit of patience for things to take time. And I wonder if, you know, there's some element of culture or the evolution of our society connected to that change in values and how they're then being represented in our policies.
You know, Kate, I really get it. I understand why it's always been a challenge for us in the State Department in general, but especially in public diplomacy, because people want to have a nice flow chart. They want to show that this happened, this money was spent, and this happened in the next 6 months.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to do when you're talking about public opinion and relationship building, the development of leaders, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I get it. My husband jokingly refers to me as instant gratification girl. I want to see results right away.
Yeah.
But that's a challenge. And I really like that you mentioned the added challenge that we have in today's technology or environment, because not only within relationship building, but in where we get our news from, because that's the other part of public diplomacy. It's about information and getting facts and making sure that what you have is based on reliable information. And, you know, we see right now that there's the dismantling of Voice of America, for example, and Radio Free Europe. These were tools and are tools for millions of citizens in other countries who live in authoritarian societies and places that don't have access to information. And when we dismantle that and other people don't get accurate information about us, let alone about the world, that makes our world a more dangerous place, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will come back to the information environment. But before we get there, I want to ask you a question about democracy, because a big part of our public diplomacy efforts is talking about democracy in other countries around the world. And that's closely linked then to, you know, our domestic context and how we practice our democracy, or like the discipline of our democracy, I've been calling it. So what's your experience been, or what's it been like to talk with other countries about democracy, and how has it shaped your own understanding of our own democracy?
It's been such an interesting arc for me, Caitlin, because, you know, I mentioned that I'd started out really learning and growing professionally and personally with the League of Women Voters, and really getting to know our own country and the importance that in a democracy, it's not just, you know, you're granted these freedoms with a responsibility. And that is not only to vote, but you've got the responsibility then to understand the issues, to be engaged, to communicate with your elected representatives, and to really understand the issues and how decisions are made, and to not just say it's somebody's job to take care of me.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because having worked a lot in Eastern Europe when I was in the nonprofit sector for the League of Women Voters, and then later as a diplomat, it was interesting to see that arc of the challenge of helping people in countries that had been closed societies, for example, communist societies, where they expected problems to be solved by others. It took a real strong mental change to realize that if I'm in a democracy, I have the tools. I just need to know what they are and how to make them work, as opposed to sitting back and just complaining about something. And that's hard because I'm guilty of that myself.
That is hard. And there are so many elements to this. Like, I mean, a healthy democracy, as you mentioned, requires an informed citizenry. And it is so difficult in today's cluttered information environment to find reliable, verifiable, and useful information. And I think that's one challenge. And then there's also the need for healthy tension and disagreement and these kinds of conversations to unfold so that we can arrive at the best possible answer. But that also requires, you know, a sense of safety, relationship, all the kinds of things that we're seeing kind of struggling in this particular moment in this environment. And I think part of this project, the goal is to have people hear each other, talk with each other, engage on difficult issues, and to begin like rebuilding some bridges. Because at the end of the day, most people want a lot of the same things, right? Like we want to be able to care for our families and have opportunities. And we want to be free in our thoughts and our expression. And we also need to be responsible about truth telling as well.
Right.
So it's sticky.
You know, I'm really glad that you're bringing this up. And it's so important that we're having these discussions to understand each other in the situation. I'm reminded, as you said that, about a time I was in Bosnia. It was soon after the war in Yugoslavia, and it was a really difficult time. I was working with some women leaders, and we met, and they were from three different communities. Some were from the Bosnian or Bosniak Muslim community, some from the Croatian, and some from the Serbian community of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And what I learned from those discussions, which were really, really hard, is that, you know, they were living in each other's communities after the war. They were internally displaced. And everyone had a horror story. And what I learned from someone who was with us, who was a conflict resolution specialist, is this isn't a competition for who has suffered the most. That if we can listen to each other and understand what someone has gone through and to say that I hear you, that if that whole, that process of just being willing to listen and acknowledge can open the door to being able to hear something else later on. And to work together. And it takes a long time to build that trust.
If somebody,
you know, for even somebody being able to disclose what they've gone through, can I trust you with my story? When I was in Poland, I think I told you earlier, there was, when we were having another chat, when I served in Poland at our embassy in Poland, we had a fabulous team of Polish colleagues who just helped make our public affairs section run. And I remember in my first week, I had a staff meeting with them to get to know them. And I was interested in their different opinions of what we could be doing differently or better. What are things that they think could be done for our bilateral relationship? Didn't hear a peep out of them. They were not open their mouths. They didn't want to disclose any personal opinion. And I remember going back to my husband saying, oh my goodness, they don't like me. They don't trust me. And I, of course, had to learn and respect that coming from another culture and, of course, having a new boss, they had to check me out first. They had to know that it was safe, that they had a supervisor with whom they could give honest opinions and not have any negative repercussions. And we ended up building a fantastic relationship, but I remember being really humbled by that. And I couldn't just go into a new situation and assume or presume that they'd trust me off the bat.
And
that was a moment I had to come to grips with.
That's so interesting. And it just brings me back to the idea that trust is everything in good policy making, because people need to be able to trust each other in order to offer dissenting views. And that's such an important part of the process of arriving at good policy, or sometimes even the least bad option in a difficult scenario, right?
You know, I remember, and without going into a lot of details of what happens in the State Department, how things work. But having that kind of trust reminds me that during the last administration, the Biden administration, when we had Secretary of State Antony Blinken, under his leadership, he heard very clearly that there were many diplomats who sharply dissented about the implementation of policy regarding the Israel and Hamas conflict in Gaza. And this has all been reported on, and understandably. But he did something very interesting. He said, okay, we're going to host a series in-person meetings where our leadership is going to listen to your concerns. And they would spend an hour or more over several sessions, anybody could join, to talk about what the concerns were, any dissent, alternative ways of moving forward. And, I can't say what the ultimate impact of it was, given that whole time, but it certainly was a model, I think, that any leader should have, which is, I hear what you're saying and I want to hear more. Mm-hmm. I respect that you're not agreeing with things.
And if there's no one in the room who's willing to speak up when they disagree with you, that's not a good thing as a leader. It's a problem.
Right, it really is.
Yeah. So what does it mean to you then to be an American, and what do you think it requires of us to be American citizens? And you already kind of hinted at some of these elements, but I want to give you the chance to share what you think about that.
Well, it's interesting. I'm feeling very complex about it, right? Not torn, but anyway, just an interesting
A lot of layers these days.
I've been brought up to always be very proud to be American, grateful. This is the land of opportunity. This is where my family came after, suffering pogroms and terrible discrimination and hardships in other countries, and were able to come to this country, were accepted, and able to help build and contribute. That doesn't come without a responsibility. And as I've learned, being an American is being able to recognize that you have a responsibility to make things a little bit better. We're trying to build a more perfect union. Our forefathers never imagined that we would get to a state of perfection.
They never said, build a flawless union.
And they didn't say, you're already there and keep it.
Right.
It is to try to keep improving. Certainly that heritage and that history on these same grounds, there were enslaved people and that whole history as well. Which is a serious one to understand. But for me, being American means appreciating and dedicating the work that I do and the service that I do to the ideals of our Constitution. And making sure that we can build that society that is based upon the democratic ideals, that we are a community of individuals that can make a difference and can work out these problems and hopefully serve as an example, a positive example.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've also been thinking about this a lot lately. Well, maybe for my entire life, but particularly lately. And I'm thinking, there's this whole, and I think every country has some version of this, but there's this whole like mythology that we've built around what it means to be an American. And it's based in some truths and some abstractions. And it's just this whole narrative. And I think sometimes people feel that calling into question certain elements of the narrative or how we put into practice our democracy, what our pluralistic society looks like, that those questions somehow mean there's not like a gratitude or a sense of patriotism or an appreciation for what it can mean to be an American. And in fact, I think it's like the greatest show of love to say,
absolutely,
I believe in you, country, and I believe that we can be better, and I think that we have all the material that we need to do remarkable things, and it's okay to say we're not there.
I cannot agree more, Kate. I mean, it's sad as you're talking about the mythology, right? Mm-hmm. Every country has its own mythology, right?
Yeah.
And there's a reason for that,
right?
And it helps to kind of define or shape an idea that we can, begin with. But these days, I've been seeing the word patriot and patriotism being used a lot and in ways that concern me.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I have, like every public servant, taken an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I don't take an oath to an individual, to a system, to a party. No, it's to the Constitution. But for example, I saw in the documentation that went forward to Congress about how to hire future public servants, only, quote, the most patriotic, unquote.
Right. What does that mean?
Would be hired.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? You're patriotic if you're serving your country.
Number of flags outside.
Number
well, you live
who
at Mount Vernon.
The most.
You live at Mount Vernon. I can't imagine anything more patriotic than like living at George Washington's estate.
It's pretty cool. I dug up a horseshoe the other day.
What?
In Mount Vernon. I was like,
that's cool.
But like, what makes someone the most patriotic? And it doesn't mean it's somebody who has that many flags or who is espousing, you know, support for one person in office. No. And that's what I'm concerned about. And I know this isn't the only time in our history that we've gone through this. My mother has told me she experienced it during the Vietnam War. You know, other times it's happened. But I think for anyone who's listening and for folks who are going through these discussions, just sort of think through these labels that we give ourselves or that we wish to give to someone else.
Yeah.
Am I better than you? Am I more patriotic than you?
Yeah. Yeah. And the power of symbolism too. The power of symbols, because I think we have come to make a lot of assumptions based on what we see. And I feel like sometimes certain groups end up co-opting, like you said, a certain label or a certain definition. And as long as we accept that, then we're also kind of complicit in letting that be the case. When in reality, there are so many different ways to be patriotic, to love your country, to be a public servant, which is what this project is all about, talking about different ways to serve our country and our communities and our families and do that at all levels. And now, you know, at a time when a lot of people who would like to be public servants in the traditional sense might not have the opportunity to think broadly about other ways that we can do that.
I'm so glad you mentioned that because, you know, we're using the term public servant, of course, and looking at federal workers, right? Whether or state level or local government. And yes, absolutely, that work is essential and that those roles are essential. Anything anyone does volunteering in the community, are you helping to rescue animals, you know, and helping out at the shelter? Are you working as a volunteer in schools, as somebody who can help in elementary school, they need some help with the readers or for tutoring. Are you helping to clean up along the Potomac River where folks may have left some trash and making it a little bit better and healthier, you know, for your own children and those who come after?
Yeah.
There are so many ways of exploring that role of a public servant. And that whole idea of public diplomacy, if we come back to that, it's not only those who are in government.
Yeah.
It's the idea that we can be, if you will, citizen ambassadors in our own communities.
Yeah, I love that. Wow, that was so full circle. I was thinking of asking you another question, but now I feel like you just brought it back around so perfectly. But I do want to ask you this because I am sure you have great thoughts to share on this topic. This work can be heavy, can be really challenging. And I'm wondering what you do or what you've explored in terms of taking care of yourself, promoting mental health and wellness in your own life, but also just more broadly in public service work.
Oh, thank you. That topic can be a real hot button for anyone. Hopefully I think it's become a little bit better since, I think, COVID. We've been talking a lot more about that on social
media. Well, it's unavoidable since COVID.
Avoidable, right. I had an interesting experience, frustrating experience that I think wouldn't be unique to me, you know, a unique situation. We had been in lockdown. I was in Bogota, Colombia, and we had been in a real pretty strong work-at-home situation for almost 2 years. Nothing like being deployed to another country. Having to work out of your apartment for 2 years. We get our vaccines, things are getting better. I started exploring, you know, taking my family out and about.
And Bogota is so beautiful.
It's a cool city.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was really safe. Everybody was wearing their masks. But I started to have problems, physical manifestations that I thought were heart problems. You know, the MC doctor sends me off to the cardiologist, and I'm, you know, if you've seen The Matrix, mm-hmm. where they're all like wired up with yeah. these tubes, so I'm like walking around for a week, totally wired up, seeing how my body's mm-hmm. ticking, and I return with the data, and they're like, yeah, no, you're fine there. I think it's another issue. And it was that I had spent so much time in like a fight or flight mode, I guess. Mm. It was that I was really focused yeah. on, I was helping my team, right? My, yeah. my staff remotely. People had lost their family members to COVID. Folks were isolated at home. You know, like everybody, we're all dealing with these situations, trying to protect your family. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, when it started to become safer, my body was like, whoa, what are you talking about?
Wow.
And what I learned from that, and what I hope I imparted also to my son, because he was witness to this, and, you know, ask for help and yeah. work through that. And what I learned is that, you know, when you are actually, especially in a leadership position, if you're willing to share that you've gone through this mm-hmm. situation, others are willing to come forward too. And
yeah.
you can build that community of support. But for those who are, you know, there's a heavy weight. And what I went through, it's not like folks who are living, who've been serving in the war zones and
yeah.
being bombed every day. That's another
right.
situation. There are people who go through family, personal hardships. But as I said earlier in the example from Bosnia, it's not a competition of who is suffering the most or dealing mm-hmm. with the hardest situation. But my one tip is like to, coming out of that, is to really just be aware that you do need to step back a little bit and take care of yourself before you can take care of others. And
yeah.
I've said to my colleagues before I just left the State Department, it's like what the flight attendants on the airplane will tell you to do
mm-hmm.
before takeoff. What is that?
Put on your own mask
Put
before
on your
you
oxygen
help others.
Mask first
yeah.
Before you help
That's
others.
A great point. And it's just
yeah.
so interesting, because I think what I'm hearing you say and what I've experienced in my own life and heard from others is that sometimes when you're in a period of like a low-level trauma where it's bearable, but you're just coping, you're surviving, you're doing what needs to be done, it's almost like the trauma of it doesn't hit you until later when things have calmed down, and it hits you like a tidal wave. I felt like I experienced that, and it made me really interested in understanding more about brain science and neural pathways. I had one really challenging pregnancy and a semi-traumatic like birth experience with one of my kids, and I mean, thankfully he's totally healthy, everything was great, but it was scary for a little while, and I felt like I was almost like a machine going through it, and after, all the emotion hit me. And
it
so
takes
I think
a long time sometimes.
Yeah. Yes. And so I think, yeah. you know, a lot of people are going through challenging things at all times. So to anybody who's listening, I think being a compassionate observer of your own experience is a really great way to approach it, because whenever we then struggle and then layer self-judgment on top of that, it's just like a recipe for disaster. So if you can observe yourself and know like, oh, this isn't normal for me, or this isn't how my body usually feels, you're in the better position to help yourself and then to seek the help that you need from others. And I'm really glad that you shared this with us and that you're giving us the opportunity to talk about this on this show, because I don't think we've talked about mental health and about this issue so explicitly, but it is, I think, relatable and relevant to the entire conversation.
Again, I'm not an expert in it by any means, but, you know, I think it's such an important issue. I know right now, especially mm-hmm. with so many people so suddenly losing, I'll say grieving, the loss mm-hmm. of their jobs, their careers, their direction, their life,
their purpose.
This is a really vulnerable time for a lot of people. And,
it is.
And we need to, and the other thing is, not always will people say help. And so if we as, you know, members of the community and those who care,
yeah.
Can keep an eye out for them, that'll be great. I know that they'll appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I think you've already helped people by sharing that message and letting them hear this, because I know a lot of public servants are listening to this show and seeing themselves reflected in the stories that we're sharing here. So thank you for doing that. And much more broadly, thank you for your public service. Thank you for your many years devoted to our country. And I really look forward to seeing what you decide to do from here, because I have no doubt there'll be cool things
Oh, thanks so much, Kate. I am really excited for the journey, because that's what it is. It's a yes. journey. So we'll see what comes next.
To the next chapter.
Yes, to the next chapter. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.